I want to begin. You may know each other. I do not know any of you. And so I would like to just invite you to introduce yourself for just 30 seconds, each person, to a person you don't already know. I'll tell you that I'm from, so here's an example. I'm Anna, I'm from Chicago. I am married to Allison, and we have a 12-year-old son, Benjamin. And I am a parent, worried citizen, and a Christian. So however you would like to identify, just get to know somebody you already know for just a minute or a total. So no matter who you are, where you're from, you are part of the whole tonight ethos of lovely sharing and conversation, and that's great. But I just want to honor the fact that we don't really know each other all that well. I don't know how any of you in this room identify in various ways, but in particular with regards to race and ethnicity. And we can't assume that anybody, no matter how we identify, has the same shared experience as white or as a person of color, or if we even like that nomenclature. So I just want us to begin with honoring the fact that we want to be inviting and gentle with one another's stories and not assuming that we already know that person's story and trajectory. For those of you who do identify either as a person of color or as someone who is white but who has very close family members or relations who are people of color, you bring particular proximity to some of these issues. For others of us, much like myself, who identify as white and grew up in a very segregated community, we have less proximity, and all is welcome. We're all at different and varying points in our trajectories of looking at these issues, and that all that experience, wherever we are today, whoever we are, is welcome and valid. For those of you who do identify either as a white person who has very close family and friends who are darker-skinned folks, or who are people of color, you may not want to always talk about white socialization and identity, and so feel free to take breaks. But for those of you who I do identify as white, like I do, my invitation is to try and be a little more comfortable with the discomfort, and to stay engaged, and to stay present. So with that in mind, and you can see this is our agenda for today, we're going to do something different each day, and I'll talk more about the next sessions at the end of this one. That's mainly to keep me on track, because I have this thing about time, and wanting to be on time, and wanting to make sure that we get in. I also have a problem of wanting to do too much, so sometimes you may need to say, Anna, slow down, or let's table that, and that's good and fine. So with that in mind, I want to just begin with, oops, that's the wrong way. Why are you here? Well, let me tell you why I'm here. I am a parent, and that kid is Ben, who is a bit older now, who's running around here. And I had no role models as a kid for what a good ally as a white person might be. I didn't have examples of how to talk about race or racism. And Allison and I really want to do better by our son. And I want him to feel comfortable in the discomfort and to be able to speak and even more to really listen and learn. So that's part of why I'm here. And I'm delighted to be here. And I want to thank, again, Chuck and Peg for the invitation. I've also want to share that I've come to the place where I really agree with Jennifer Harvey that colorblindness just doesn't work. I was raised in that model, that we treat everybody the same. I don't see color. Meanwhile, everybody around me was white from 0 to 11. And what I really do agree with is that this approach causes serious harm to ourselves, to our children, however we identify racially and ethnically, but it causes a kind of particular direct harm often to people of color, but it also really malforms or misshapes identity as white people. So I want to move us beyond that a bit this week. And what Jennifer Harvey says, that some of you may have looked at, urging white people to face head-on and proactively create more opportunities to teach our kids and ourselves about racism means inviting them and us to accept the inevitability of discomfort. But we can do this. Remember, for those of us who are raised Lutheran like me, one of the big models of Martin Luther is sin boldly, right? So we can be uncomfortable. We can negotiate it. So with that in mind, I'm going to start today by telling you a bit of my uncomfortable story, just as a way of getting to know me and, again, the trajectory that brought me here. So I grew up, and my first earliest memories of childhood were in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I lived the majority growing up in South Dakota until sixth grade, and then my mom and I moved to Chicago, Illinois. So for those first 11 years, as I said a minute ago, everyone on the street, in my school, at my church, in any social function, was white. And I learned that I was white before I was in second grade. So I'm going to date myself, and this was in the 1970s. And how many of you remember or have heard about the AIM uprisings in western South Dakota, the Native Americans and the occupation there? Well, I heard about that on the news, local and on the TV. My dad, by the way, was a Lutheran pastor, and my mom was a nurse and a nurse educator. And I was very young, but I remember hearing about that and asking my dad, or maybe both of them. And my dad said, oh yeah, well, we live on stolen land, and they're coming to take it back. Now, that wasn't super helpful the way he said it, because it struck terror in my heart, literally thinking they are coming to take my house. And he also wasn't great at explaining. He, at that time, was an alcoholic, not yet recovering, so he didn't really put in a great framework, and he probably just left the room or something. So that night, I had a hard time falling asleep. But it also, again, well before second grade, I already felt embarrassed, because my house that I was in was on somebody else's property, and I didn't know what to do about that, and I felt uncomfortable. Then in eighth grade, skipping forward, Mrs. Roth, she taught me the history of slavery and colonization and the treatment of the Lakota and Cherokee, about segregation, Jim Crow, civil rights, and I was fascinated. I mean, I loved this material, but I also felt profoundly ashamed, and I don't think if you had asked me, I would have had words for that. But I can look back and tell you I just felt awful in my own skin, very uncomfortable, but no language for what to do about that. I had no examples, no role models in history that were given to me in school or in my own way of our family narratives talking about what white identity and privilege is or how we can practice solidarity with communities of color. And at the same time, I was told I was never described by my family as white. I was told to be proud of my Norwegian Germanic heritage. Now, I'm half and half, but to be honest with you, really it was the Norwegian that was emphasized. That was the good one. The German side was not so popular. So I was all into that. I thought that was great. So I would say I was Norwegian, or Norwegian American, or I was South Dakotan, but I didn't even have language for describing myself as white. So very early on, by their silences and by what was said, I was taught by the adults in my family that talking about race was uncomfortable, that it wasn't really done, and at the same time, relatives would casually make crude jokes or utter disparaging comments about Native Americans, about black people, about women. And I have to tell you, I adored my maternal grandparents. They were not crude or crass at all. And they were just everything to me. But one day out of the blue, maybe this was after I moved to Chicago, I was 11 or 12. I don't remember why this came up, but my grandfather said that I should never marry a black man. And I was kind of confused, and I think I probably gave a meek objection, like, why not, or what's the problem, or something like that. And my grandmother then said something to the effect of, well, they have enough of their own kind, and we have enough of ours. And I just was very confused and disappointed, and it was such an odd thing to say. I mean, at 11 or 12, I was really not thinking about getting married. And of course, we can always wonder now. I didn't marry a man, a black man, but I married Allison, so I don't know how gone over. I didn't do it, Pop, I was hoping you're okay with that. So then I moved to Chicago with my mom, and she went to a master's program, and she walked me to school the first day to meet my new teacher, and up until that point, I'd always had white women as my teachers. And down the hall walks Leon Hudnall, my first male teacher, and certainly the first African-American teacher, or even African-American person I'd ever known or spoken to. And it was the first time in sixth grade that I was in a classroom where whites were not the majority. It was a very integrated, multiracial classroom. And I made friends of different races. And I have to say, I think it was around that time when I started to actively try to prove that I was a good one, that I was one of the good white people. And I didn't know how to do it. I made a fool of myself. I still do. And I floundered. And I still do. So then for a long time, I went to undergrad, seminary, PhD. I spent a lot of energy trying to justify myself as a good white person. I wanted the validation of people of color. I want to be a good ally. And I haven't always been good at one. And I've stepped on toes. And I realize now that part of my need for validation is part of white socialization. We need the attention on us. Please reassure me that I'm okay, that you like me, that you're comfortable around me, that you don't think ill of me. And that's a whole lot of energy that people of color have to deal with and negotiate, and that's a burden on them. So I'm going to tell you more stories about me. I'm going to tell you about my close friendship with the Reverend Dr. Annie Ruth Powell. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about my son and a conversation we had about his white blonde hair. But for now, I'm going to stop talking because I want you to do a little bit of reflection. We're going slowly. We have 5 sessions. I hope you can come back. And I hope you'll tell people, don't be afraid. She's not going to make you feel guilty because that doesn't do anyone any good. Guilt and shame is not creative for the moral life. So that's not what this is about. But it is about understanding and owning up and taking some responsibility, and then imaginatively, creatively thinking, what can we do constructively, pragmatically, to be more comfortable in our own skin, and also to be better allies. But we're going slowly, so I think a good way to begin is for you to just take a few minutes, and if you brought paper and pens or pencils, that's great. If you need something to write with, here are some pens, and here's some scratch paper. And I'm going to give you about 8 or 10 minutes, and here is the prompt. I would like you to just reflect and write a little bit. You're not going to have to read what you write to anyone else, okay? So this is going to be kept private. I am going to ask you to talk about something, but not directly about what you wrote. So for these next few minutes, write about an experience that you have had in your own life with whiteness. No matter how we identify racially, ethnically, we have all had experiences with whiteness. So, just for yourself, reflect on that a bit, and I'll keep time. If you have paper, use your own paper. If you need scratch paper, it's coming around. Thanks.
Are you welcome? Come on in.
Yeah, I'm just doing a little reflection on that prompt. The scratch paper is right there, too. You can take one of those. We'll take back 2 more minutes or so. We have plenty of time. So, with that exercise and just some food for thought, I would like you to gather with in groups of three or four, and I hope that it could be, or just two, if that is where you would like to be, but I would really hope that you speak again with at least one other, if not two other people that you don't already know. Now, you're not going to talk exactly about what you wrote, but I would like you to talk about how it felt. What was it like for you to reflect on that prompt? What opened up for you? What bubbled up? Just share a little bit of that. And again, I'd like to not rush you too much, but I do want some time for large group discussion and then to chart out where we're going from here. So I'll keep track of time. But in groups of, if you want, feel comfortable in a pair, or groups of three or four, but again, try to make an acquaintance with at least one or two other people that you don't yet know. Okay?
Three of us, okay?
I'm so happy. 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 And in fact, it took me a while to be on one hand, all the good things that we had in the first. I don't even know what they mean. See, there's a show, you know, their head was there.
I want to just check in briefly.
And
I can ask Oscar to pause for 1 minute. If you're anything like me and are an extrovert, I'm just wondering, have the folks who are more hesitant or gotten a chance to share some of their stories? How are we doing?
How much time do we have?
Definitely 5 more minutes, but I just want to keep it circulating. I have had to work hard over this over the years to not just talk all the time because I like to talk. I'm still learning. I'm still recovering. But, so make sure it keeps moving, okay? Take another 5-6 minutes, and if you need more time, let me know.
I'm going to
About that exercise. What was shared in the small group that you would like to either raise as a point for the large group or a question that emerged for you? Let's take note of a few things.
I can.
Sure, and please speak, tell me your name and...
Derek.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I got out of my experience and what we're talking here is that there's there's an ugliness out there that we all deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But this is another ugliness that's not related to men or women. It's just out there that, that people of color have to deal with, or people that have some deviances that have to deal with. And, I don't know if it's ever going to go away. I can't imagine it going away.
Well, let's stay with the first part. We'll get to the strategies on Friday, so I hope you come back. All right. But right now, I think you said something really important, Derek, in your group, which is that it is we all have wounds. We all have sites of vulnerability. None of us is all powerful, all bad, all the time. So, for example, in the classroom, I have a lot of power. I'm a tenured professor. When I'm walking home late at night, I don't feel all that, certainly on any sports field. I can hike, but I can't even keep up with the Holden staff anymore. So, you know, it's humbling. But the idea is that none of us is simply an oppressor or oppressed, but we all have these sites where power circulates in different ways. So it could be, it would be much more comfortable for me to sit in my identity as a woman and as a gay woman and talk about that vulnerability and worry about the places where I don't have power and ask others to advocate for me. But I need to really own where I do have power. As a person who doesn't have to worry about job security, who makes a decent income, who has health insurance, who's white, who, and to understand and have empathy in that it's not a competition about who's, but it is understanding that it's very particular. And if I think, as a gay person, that heterosexism is a heterosexual problem, then I really need to understand that racism is a white person's problem, and what am I going to do about it? So I think a lot of times people feel like, hey, I don't have it so great. You know, I have a hard time, or I have different struggles. But this is a whole other thing. And to let it be there, and to honor that, is important. Other thoughts that came up from the small groups?
Well, I was...
Tell us your name, please.
Oh, my name's Anne.
Anne?
And I was sharing with the group that the feelings that was stirring up, going over, the memory was being ashamed of my family.
Yeah.
My extended family.
You're so afraid of what people are going to say or do, and it's hard to go home for Thanksgiving dinner or other family times, mm-hmm. let alone bring home somebody that is not of that same background. So a lot of it is figuring out what do we do with that shame and that guilt, and naming it. Other thoughts, and I can write things on the board and then I forgot to. But. Yes, please. Your name?
My name is Lori.
Lori.
And we had a great conversation here, and something that we shared or talked about was the fact that, you know, people were saying, yeah, you know, 3 years ago we felt like, wow, this is, you know, this was, we were on such a better page, and but really we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just suppressed, and it's been suppressed for
the
beginning of, you know, it goes way, way back.
How right.
Oh, it's just now. The anger's just now. And it's like, you know, it's just kind of pushed down.
Yeah, a black president and first lady do not solve racism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard to buy ammunition the whole time.
Go ahead, sorry.
It was hard to buy ammunition for sporting purposes.
Yeah.
The whole time we had a black president.
Yeah.
It was crazy. I had no idea until I went to try to buy stuff.
Because people were stockpiling, right?
What are people afraid?
Yeah. And the other thing I just want to, this is going to come up more tomorrow, so I just want to say a preview. There is a tendency in me sometimes also, when I hear the word racist and racism, I want to put it all on those red hats. I want to put it all on the person who did the shooting in El Paso. I want to name it as a problem that comes in certain parts of the country rather than others. And I think there is truth to the fact that there is extreme racist violence happening that is not unprecedented, but is acute. It's all on the surface now. And yet, I also know that there are a lot of other wounds and cuts and harms that happen in school playgrounds, in our churches, in my neighborhood, that also do a kind of violence. By people like me who are well-intentioned, who want to be known as good people. And I think that's harder to own and name. It's because we want to distance ourselves from that, many of us. I certainly do. That's not me. That president does not speak for me. But I can't let myself off the hook either. So it's there's some, we'll say more about that tomorrow. Yes, go ahead and tell us everyone your name.
Well, I'm sorry, it's Judy. I think it's, to me, one of the realizations was the unconscious white privilege.
Yeah.
The talk I had with my boys was not the same as the talk
right.
that my neighbors had with their child.
About police or about?
Why? My talk was about sex. Their talk was about police. When we talked about having the talk, we weren't talking the same talk.
Yeah, yeah.
And also about just generational wealth. You know, what home ownership. You know, we were talking about redlining this morning.
That, yeah.
What home ownership has meant for white wealth.
Yep.
And how many years it would take to even that out, or you know, even try.
Yeah.
And you know, well, you don't. You know, people say, well, we worked hard, we got our home. Well,
yeah.
You were allowed to buy a home.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to come up a lot on Thursday, Judy. We're going to really explore the structural systemic racism and also on tomorrow on how history matters. There's an impatience among some people to say, that was ancient history.
Yeah.
Without understanding how these things pay forward and how history is really breathing in the present. I'm going to tell you a story tomorrow, as I mentioned, about my son, who happens to be right up there. And he gave me permission to tell this story about his hair. But his hair illustrates history and the present and white privilege. So stay tuned for tomorrow. other thoughts? Yes, go ahead.
I shared that I went to a high school after growing up in a religiously mixed community. Went to a high school where there was about one quarter black. It was a big high school in St. Paul. And then moved because my family built a house to an area that was very white. And I was very smug about having been in a school with black students. And then I said to a friend who continued on and graduated, so, any of the black kids come to the reunions? Nope. Did the Jewish kids come to the reunions? Oh yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Did you have any one of the black kids over from high school when we were in high school together? Neither did I. And what's happened to that neighborhood, I go to a black theater in that neighborhood to try to expand some of my understanding, and it's telling the story, the racial story over and over again. And I can't believe how dumb I've been all my life. I mean, I just really, it's stark to me to think that I can be this age and not know more than I do.
Tell me your name.
Cindy.
Sorry. Cindy or Sandy?
Cindy,
right there.
So I can remember.
Cindy, you are not. So first of all, you're not dumb, and that's important. But it is about white privilege that we can create a bubble for ourselves and live in such a bubble. And we're going to talk quite a bit about that on Wednesday and the stages of white identity formation. So it's just what happens because of this culture that we have created over time. And that is a luxury, but it is not. It's just because we have to break some bubbles, which you're doing. So, other last thoughts before I move to something else? Yes, please.
Well, my name is Linda.
Thank you, Linda.
In reflecting on, you know, I have like a whole list of experiences about racial stuff growing up with the mother that was really pretty bigoted and caused all kinds of things to happen with me in terms of what I was allowed to do and who I was allowed to see, you know. But I managed to have lots of experiences with diversity despite that, or possibly even to rebel about it a little bit. But now I'm in a time in my life where I can do whatever I want and see whoever I want. And I'm living in, I have very few friends of color,
mm-hmm.
when I would really like to have more friends of color and feel like I need to do something intentional to make that happen.
Absolutely. It doesn't just happen, unfortunately, naturally. We have to take some work. But that's a wonderful insight, Linda. And I wanted to come back to Cindy, something you said, you talked about your school. Another historical process that we really need to understand is schools. And how is it that in 2019, in many, many cities and rural areas, schools are now much more segregated than they were in the 1960s and early 70s? Mm-hmm. Joe Biden and busing, what happened? Right? So that's one, if you heard that in the first debate. Yeah. Oh, come on, projector.
I knew. I sent a clean filter tonight.
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to skip forward, and then we can shut off the darn projector. So I'm going to do some show and tell with these books. But this, my dear friend said, Anna, you're like a steam train. You noticed on all that writing how much I wanted to do in 5 sessions. She said, are you teaching a semester-long course? No, but I just love this content. I think it's so important. So I've made some revisions so that you can hike, you can breathe, you can nap, you can enjoy where you are. But Tuesday, we're going to look at history. These historical processes, particularly around white Christianity. So how white Christianity really is implicit, complicit. Mm-hmm. And this is a very different story than what Mark told this morning about the AME, the formation of the AME Church, if you were able to make that session. So again, I really want us to understand these processes. So if you did happen to read the chapter one, that's by a different Harvey, not Jennifer Harvey, Paul Harvey, on A Servant of Servants Shall He Be, I am going to be talking about that tomorrow, but I'm going to recap it and you don't have to, but it's in the library. And that's going to be our focus, but not only that history, but how, again, implications, how this is still playing out. Wednesday, this is going to be stages from Janet Helms, who wrote this really great book, A Race is a Nice Thing to Have, A Guide to Being a White Person or Understanding the White People in Your Life. And this is a really wonderful guide because it gives us some language for understanding some of this vexedness that we have and this where we feel stuck or where we don't know how to get beyond being caught up in wanting to be a good white person or, you know, wanting a more diverse friendships but not knowing how to make that happen. It really helps map it out a little bit. It gives us some language and how we can move a little bit. It also starts to answer the question of, I'm white, does that mean I'm inherently a racist? Mm-hmm. So we're going to kind of go there a little bit on Wednesday. And on Thursday, then, it might seem late to you, but that's where I want to actually define racism. If you want me to define it sooner, if you're saying, Anna, that's unrealistic, we need to know this now. We need an operating definition. I will do it tomorrow, just, you know. But I was going to do it on Thursday, and that's where I've asked you to read a chapter from this amazing book, who's from Seattle, So You Want to Talk About Race, Ijoma Oluo. It's so readable. It's so engaging. It's in the library, if you have time. And then we have options. I have about a 25-minute video that traces housing, what happened with housing, as Judy was explaining. It's a wonderful video. It's called Race, the Power of an Illusion, because race is a social construction, and yet it has very real effects. My area of focus is racial, ethnic, socioeconomic inequalities in health and healthcare in this country and globally, and also health implications of climate change and how that is disproportionately being borne by people of color. They're living on predominantly on the front lines of climate change, whereas I'm much more insulated for the time being. So on Thursday, I can also show you a shorter video on black maternal mortality and talk about that. I want to do both. I can't do both. So if you want to put a pitch in for one or the other, you can let me know. But the other thing then on day 5 is where we're really going to focus on allyships. And we're going to get concrete and strategies. How do we enact an anti-racist ethic in our own spheres of influence and lives? And I would also love to show you and explain what implicit bias is all about. How we don't even realize that we're acting in ways which make us the standard of humanity when we don't want to be, we just want to be human. But it's kind of like, you know, assuming things about time or about how worship looks or about who's in charge, who you ask for assistance, who you assume is going to have helpful information. All of this stuff is about implicit biases that we carry. And they are really implicit, they are really pernicious and toxic in healthcare, in policing, in public policy. I mean, that's where the power differentials really show up. I mean, everybody can stereotype, everybody has implicit bias, but if you're in charge of the budget, if you're in charge of what happens in the ER, if you are in, or the ICU, if you are in charge of how you train police officers, wow, it has different effects than depending on your social location. So I would love to talk about that, but I'm not quite sure when we're going to do it. So I'm just telling you, there's an overflow. And to that point, this is, in case you cannot come back, I'm going to hand this out every time. These are resources for viewing, for reading, great ideas for book groups, for your church or other kinds of book groups that you're a part of. If you really want a wonderful memoir on just someone becoming more aware of her own whiteness, this is by Debbie Irving, Waking Up White. It's phenomenal. It's great for individual or group reflection. She is from a more affluent socioeconomic class, so you may say, I don't relate to all of that, you know, but it is a very good opening into that. Another really excellent book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, by Robin DiAngelo. Highly recommend this. And there are audiobooks, right? There are podcasts. Yes?
I was just going to say when, I can't remember what your name is, but you, right here, we're talking about
Cindy.
I felt so dumb, you know? That reminded me of that Waking Up White book where she learns about the, what's it called, the GI Bill.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Then not everybody benefited from the GI Bill. Yeah. I also just cannot recommend this book highly enough. We're only going to look at one chapter of it, but Ijoma Oluo's book, So You Want to Talk About Race. Phenomenal. Finally, this book is near and dear to my heart, Raising White Kids, because I am a parent. And I could have focused these sessions just on being white parents but and grandparents. But and maybe if I ever come back to Holden, I would do that. But I suggested chapters for today as kind of background reading. But she's also written another book, Dear White Christians, for those longing for racial reconciliation. And her point in that book is that you now need to know the history of black churches and white churches. And that before we can all come together in unity and love and oneness, we need to deal with reparations. So it's a really great book. But this book is not so much focused on congregations, it's focused on parenting. And it's highly accessible, readable, engaging. I love it. I'm going to be using it for our last session a little bit. And also she wrote a blog for white women who want to learn calculus while the building school is on fire. We're going to be looking at that as well on Friday. She is all over it now. She is on podcasts, on NPR. Her whole profile has blown up. She's really something. She's also a friend of mine.
Are these going to be in the library?
Full disclosure.
What?
So, yeah, so I think some are in the bookstore and the library. I didn't put all of them. I think these two should be around.
Those two are both in the bookstore, and also the...
White Fragility is, I think, because it was on somebody else's reading list.
It may be, but I know the one Waking Up White is.
Is?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
There are not lots of copies, but there are some.
And old,
they're hardcover.
But you can always, as soon as you have access to the internet, get them again, right? So, however you want to. So, does this make sense to you? Does this sound appealing? Are we good?
Yeah.
Does anybody want to signal right now? I don't know anything about the housing or wealth or healthcare. Anybody want to put in a pitch or just let me do what I want to do?
I'd love to see the housing.
I want to see the housing.
Yeah. I love this housing story. I mean, I hate it, and I love it. So, all right, good.
Are you going to be talking anything that touches on Jim Crow in the North?
Well, certainly housing.
The housing does. Okay. I was wondering.
Yeah. As a woman who's always lived in the Midwest, Chicago is the lowest in the 48 that I've lived. I also had that illusion for a long time. Like, well, I can't be that racist because I have not lived in the South. And again, I have good white liberal parents, and they didn't equip me to deal with racism, but they wanted me to be a good Christian in many ways, right? And they voted Democrat, so how can we have these problems if we voted Democrat as my family? Well, I'm really glad you're here, and I really look forward to our continuing conversation, and I hope you're able to come back as you are. Come for all or one or two, invite others. Onward, right? We can do this.